We lose and find things all the time. It seems there are no limits on size or importance. We can lose our keys, lose our phones, lose our loved ones. It goes on and on. We can also find our keys, find our wallets, find our phones, find great bargains, find great places to vacation, find people to love. Our guest this hour considers such subtractions and additions in her own life and paints a broader canvas in a new memoir. Catherine Schultz is the author of Lost and Found. Catherine Schultz is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of her previous book, Being Wrong, about how we dislike that situation. Catherine won a Pulitzer Prize for her New Yorker article on the likelihood and effects of a big Cascadia earthquake in our part of the world. Catherine Schultz, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Did the response to the really big one, that article, surprise you? I mean, people in Oregon have been talking about it for years, but it seemed like your article in the New Yorker really riveted attention.
You know, it did really surprise me. You never know when you sit down to write something what kind of impact it's going to have. And in the case of a story like that, you know, in your wildest dreams, one person will read it and bolt their homes to their foundations or, you know, do something to make their lives a little safer. But I certainly had no idea it was going to have the kind of effect that it did, partly because, as you say, so many of my colleagues across the region and also folks in emergency management and seismic safety had been beating the drum of the Cascadia subduction zone for so long. So, no, I didn't see it coming. It was a real shock. And I just hope it did, you know, make some people's lives a little bit safer in the aftermath.
It's interesting the other ways in which it peeled back some information layers for people. I interviewed Chris Goldfinger a few months ago, and even he said he only knew the New Yorker as something you see in the waiting room at the dentist's office.
It's true, although, you know, I'm so grateful, given that he had kind of only a passing familiarity with it. He was so generous with his time, and I couldn't have written that piece without folks like him, you know, scientists and city planners and policymakers who were willing to just sit down and spend literally hours educating me so that I could, you know, write it as hopefully as accurately as possible.
Well, congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize for the really big one.
Thank you.
So to this book now, I certainly sympathize with the loss of your father. But interesting that the term that you needed to use is lost my father. I mean, because you are one of many people, it seems like, who struggle with the appropriate terms to use for death.
Yeah, I did. You know, it's funny how difficult it is for so many of us to just be plain spoken about this. And you know, when someone dies, simply say as much, you know, he died, he's dead. We often resort to kind of roundabout terminology to say this very simple thing. You know, we talk about how someone passed or someone is no longer with us or this kind of thing. And I understand why. It's hard to be blunt about death. And of course, you never want to, you know, upset someone else when you're speaking to someone who's lost someone, although, of course, they are well aware that someone they love has died. But I had always been really uncomfortable with these kind of euphemisms. And so it was a real shock after my father died to find myself really gravitating towards this language of loss. And to be honest, part of what motivated the book, or at least the first section of it, that lost section, was that experience and that surprise, which for me just raised the question of, like, well, why do we say this? You know, why on earth would I put my beloved late father in the same category as, you know, my iPhone that I left who knows where or the sock that vanished in the washing machine? You know, is there something meaningful about this? Is it just a linguistic coincidence? Or is there some way that these very different kinds of losses can help us make sense of loss as a phenomenon overall?
Do you have a copy of the book handy?
If I stand up and move about 6 feet, yes, I do.
Okay. I wonder if I could impose upon you to read. There's a couple of paragraphs that really kind of come right to the heart of this, starting at the bottom paragraph on page 19.
Sure. Page 19. Here we are. Do you want just that paragraph, or you'll cut me off?
Those two paragraphs. Yeah, the next two paragraphs. Yeah, right.
Okay.
To the break.
Mm-hmm. Sure. We'll do. In the end, this may be why certain losses are so shocking. Not because they defy reality, but because they reveal it. One of the many ways that loss instructs us is by correcting our sense of scale, showing us the world as it really is. So enormous, complex, and mysterious that there is nothing too large to be lost. And, conversely, no place too small for something to get lost there. A missing wedding ring can turn the modest geography of an urban park into the Rocky Mountains. Losing sight of your child during a hike can turn a peaceful stretch of stream and forest into a formidable wilderness. Like awe and grief, to which it is closely related, loss has the power to instantly resize us against our surroundings. We are never smaller, and the world never larger, than when something important goes missing. It is this harsh corrective to our sense of being central, competent, and powerful that makes even trivial losses so difficult to accept. To lose something is a profoundly humbling act. It forces us to confront the limits of our mind, the fact that we left our wallet at the restaurant, the fact that we can't remember where we left our wallet at all. It forces us to confront the limits of our will, the fact that we are powerless to protect the things we love from time and change and chance. Above all, it forces us to confront the limits of existence, the fact that, sooner or later, it is in the nature of almost everything to vanish or perish. Over and over, loss calls on us to reckon with this universal impermanence, with the baffling, maddening, heartbreaking fact that something that was just here can be, all of a sudden, just gone.
Catherine, just the way you get into scale in that selection I asked you to read is just tremendous. I mean, how did I lose my car in this lot, you know, on the big scale? How did I lose my keys in these pants while I'm wearing them is on the other end of the scale. There are just so many different ways that we consider the use of the word loss.
Well, first of all, thank you. You're my ideal reader because I really am interested in scale. You know, it's fascinating to me that here we are, you know, these humans with these enormous brains, and our everyday experience is just packed with interestingness, and our lives are so rich and full and fascinating to us. And then, you know, you pan out just a little bit and you get all the way down to the molecular and all the way out to the cosmic. And on some level, you know, viewed like that, it's like, well, no wonder we lose things all the time. The world is a very, very large place. And I am interested in our position in it. So it's kind of you to draw attention to the question of scale. And I think both loss and discovery do exactly that. You know, finding is often similarly an experience of astonishment at the scope of the world. You know, you can't believe something dropped into your lap given all the other places it could be, you know, all the other people who could have found it. But, you know, unlike with loss, of course, that's an incredibly rewarding experience. And instead of feeling a kind of fear in the face of the vastness of the universe, we feel sort of awe and gratitude.
It's not just a spatial thing, it's a temporal thing, too, because you point out that you lost your father and your New Yorker password expired around the same time, so, you know, there's that. But, and you don't make us wait long to get to know your father, and wow, what an intellect, what a mind, especially for languages.
Yeah, it's true. You know, my father spoke 7 languages. He was a Jewish refugee. He came to this country via a very unconventional immigration route that took him from his birthplace in Tel Aviv, just before the establishment of the State of Israel, surprisingly to post-war Germany, and then finally to Detroit, where he and his family settled and where he grew up from his teenage years on. But, you know, when he arrived in this country, he spoke German and Yiddish and Hebrew and French, but not a lick of English. And by the time I was born and had the pleasure of, you know, growing up learning English at his feet, he was truly just the most eloquent, creative, enthusiastic user of language you could ever possibly meet. And despite it being the last of his many languages, you know, way more articulate than I could ever hope to be. But yes, I'm of course very grateful because I make my living with words, and it's clear to me that I owe that quite directly to my father.
You mentioned about him having to move around. So in his third home, basically in the United States, where he settled in Cleveland. But what about his grandparents' generation? What had happened to them through the course of the Second World War?
Yeah, I mean, my father's life story, you know, quite sadly, really comports with this theme of loss, but on its grandest scale, you know, the absolute opposite end of the spectrum from, you know, losing your pen in the couch or losing your iPhone or whatever material object it may be. My grandmother was born on a shtetl in central Poland to a quite large Jewish family. And when it became clear that the Second World War was coming, they had the means to get exactly one of their children to safety. And through a kind of terrible calculation, I can't imagine having to make, they settled on their youngest daughter and sent her to Tel Aviv through what we think was probably an arranged marriage to a much older man. And while she was living there and you know, getting married, and when my father was born, her entire family, so that was 11 siblings and her parents, were sent to Auschwitz. And of those 13 family members, only one walked out alive at the end of the war. Her oldest sibling, my great-aunt Edja, survived and was actually the first to resettle in Detroit, but the rest of the family perished in the Holocaust.
Did your father say out loud that, because he was, as you point out in the book, I mean, he lost keys and wallets and directions often. Did he ever say out loud that these were little losses compared to the things that his family had lost before him?
He didn't make the explicit comparison, but he embodied it emotionally. You know, it's true. My father, I said his family history embodies this really horrifying and sweeping end of the spectrum of loss. But my dad, in his own adult life, embodied the trivial and the comic end. He could not, for the life of him, keep track of his car keys, or for that matter, his car. and you know, he never said, "Well, you know, I have known these." Terrible and irreparable losses, and so, you know, all the rest of this seems trivial to me. But he certainly said quite explicitly, you know, it's an object, who cares, it's replaceable, this is not the important stuff in life. And he, in fact, had this kind of wonderful easy come, easy go attitude toward all of the many, many things he mislaid over the course of his lifetime, which I think was occasionally maddening for my very organized mother, whose job it was to find them. But mostly she saw what we all did, which is that it's a great gift, actually, to not become distraught in a disproportionate way when, you know, relatively trivial material objects vanish from our lives. It happens all the time. It's not of much consequence, even if it causes a certain amount of, you know, hassle and chaos in the moment.
Let me mention his name here. It is Isaac Schultz, your father. I smiled at your sister getting a pension for losing things from Isaac, and she became a cognitive scientist.
It's true. She did. You know, my father was kind of figuratively an absent-minded professor, figurative because although he did sometimes teach law, he was more a lawyer than a professor. But my sister, an actual professor, certainly inherited the absent-minded professor gene. She is absolutely brilliant. She studies the workings of the mind, but the you know, part of her mind that's meant to keep track of the material world is, you know, I think it was preempted by higher causes and is busy thinking up deeper thoughts than where did I leave my wallet this morning.
That's something like the comic book character The Flash, you know, the 1960s version, where he was the fastest man alive, but he was always showing up late for things.
Yeah, exactly.
Catherine Schultz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about her memoir, Lost and Found, about a period in her life when there was both of those things on a grand scale, finding the person she ended up marrying and losing her father in about 18 months, and lots of other stuff going on in the middle there. If you'd like to join our conversation on the Exchange, you're welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to your sister and her work as a cognitive scientist. She was going to help figure out a period when it seemed like your father Isaac's mind was going, and actually that period had an end.
Yeah, it did, and we were incredibly fortunate about that. You know, one of the, I think, most difficult kind of losses anyone can face is cognitive loss. You know, it's excruciating if it's happening to you, or you dread it happening to you because maybe you know you have a family history of Alzheimer's or dementia, and it's certainly devastating for loved ones. You know, when someone we adore begins to you know, experience that kind of mental slippage, there's a reason people describe it as the absolute hardest thing to go through. And I don't mean to make light of physical suffering, which of course is excruciating as well, but it's terrible to watch the cognitive decline of someone you love. And in the case of my father, who had such a towering intellect and was so inseparable from his mind and his joy and delight in deep thought, you know, and in language. It was incredibly painful to see him lose his bearings in his own brain. And as I said, we were very fortunate because, you know, we assumed while it was happening what one would, which is he was older and was succumbing to dementia and that we had begun a long and irreversible decline. As it turned out, my father also suffered from a quite mysterious autoimmune disorder. We still to this day don't understand exactly what it was, but we do know that if he was not on a sufficiently high dose of steroids, these problems would flare up, and they were devastating problems. I mean, they were life-threatening problems. And so this team of doctors was forever trying to keep his symptoms under control. And unfortunately, when you don't really know what's happening with the disease and all you can do is address the symptoms, I think a really common thing that happens is you get a kind of cascade of prescription responses. You know, you put them on steroids, but steroids make people jittery and unable to sleep, and so maybe you put them on an anxiolytic and a soporific, and those have other weird side effects. So soon you're taking drugs to treat the side effects of the drugs you're taking to treat some other side effects. And, you know, the long and the short of it is my dad wound up on a cocktail of prescription medication that was, in fact, the root cause of his cognitive decline. And I say we were fortunate because, although the whole experience was quite terrible for all involved, it did have an end and a resolution. And at some point, you know, my sister, after a particularly acute episode of cognitive confusion from my dad that landed him in the hospital, she asked his doctors to start taking him off of anything that wasn't actively saving his life. And it was honestly incredible. I mean, I want to, you know, cautionary note to listeners. On the one hand, I absolutely think everyone should interrogate the drugs that they and their loved ones are taking and make sure they're not the kind of covert cause of cognitive decline. On the other hand, I think we were very fortunate in how this turned out for us, because truly within 36 hours, my father, after 2 years of being borderline unrecognizable, at least intermittently, was just absolutely himself. You know, it was like his whole brain came roaring back to life. And you know, speaking of losing and finding, it's yeah. I'm sure as any parent who's ever lost sight of a child for a minute and feared the worst and then, you know, saw them around the bend or something, there's truly nothing more incredible than thinking you've lost a loved one and suddenly getting them back. So it was quite a remarkable experience, and I'm grateful every day that my sister kind of cracked the problem of what was going on.
That is amazing, and good for her for getting bold and saying, look, you know, here's the deal. What keeps him alive? Keep him on that. Everything else, phase him off of that. And the result was just phenomenal. But I wonder, Catherine, over the course of his many trips to the hospital, if you guys had gotten lulled into some sense of thinking, well, you know, Dad gets bad, and then he gets better, and he comes home, and that always happens.
I think that's true, you know, certainly to some extent. I mean, I know the first couple of times that my father was hospitalized, early on he had some cardiac issues that landed him in the hospital, but as he got older, it really was this kind of mysterious underlying disorder, and he would periodically, you know, show up in the ICU or we'd get a phone call. And, you know, the first several times it was, of course, terrifying. You know, you absolutely fear the worst, and you rush home, and It's just unbelievably distressing for me, for my sister, for my mother, for everyone. And then, yeah, my dad, despite being in objectively kind of terrible health, really just kept living. You know, he just triumphed over every one of these. And, you know, a few days or a week or worst case scenario, a month later, you know, there you would be sitting in the living room with him and he would be talking about, you know, his favorite Dickens novel or, you know, drudging up the names of, you know, minor sports figures who'd been dead for 40 years. He was just absolutely seeming like his usual indomitable self and his towering intellect utterly intact. And I do think it's, you know, it's so funny. We all know we're mortal, and yet it's so easy to think otherwise, I suppose, because it's so tempting to think otherwise. And so, yes, it's not that it was ever not alarming to hear that my dad was hospitalized, and every time I did rush home, but the sense of extremis and the just jolt of fear and dread did lessen over time because he kept getting better. And in fact, when he was hospitalized for that final time, I had no idea at the beginning it was going to be the final time. I did go straight home and went to the hospital. But I didn't have my heart in my mouth. I didn't think, oh, you know, this is the end. I thought, nope, here we go again, and he's probably going to be just fine.
Huh. And, you know, you point out, that's well worded, of course, but that in his final days, that the doctors tried everything under the sun to help him, except to die in peace. Did they not even have any idea what was happening here?
You know, I suppose the most courteous thing we could do is get them on the phone and ask them that question. My sense is they probably did. You know, I mean, my father was in kind of all systems failure by the final weeks of his life. And I know that doctors who were not on his medical team but simply friends of his were able to walk in the room and look at the situation and say to us, you know, I think this is the end. And I cannot begin to describe to you how grateful we were for the doctors who leveled with us in that way. I think it's very hard for doctors. You know, I think they are tasked with saving lives.
Sure.
And they are tasked with looking at specific systems, and they are tasked with problem solving. And I think you can get so kind of focused on those immediate challenges that it can be very difficult to step back and say, well, what's actually going on here? And if I solve this one problem, am I playing whack-a-mole? Is there just another problem? And is this person just dying and that's the reality? And even if we could stave that off or save this person, at what price? You know, what is life going to be like for this person after all of these interventions and kind of Hail Mary efforts? And I wish it were more common to make those kinds of inquiries. I know for my family, at least, we certainly did. My sister did. My mother did. I did. But it was not. It took a surprising amount of very direct questioning from us to get the doctors to kind of come along there with us. Now, I should say that the moment that we decided, actually, he is not going to survive this, at least not in any way he would ever want to, and switched to hospice care, those people were incredible. You know, talk about people who don't have a problem speaking plainly about death, to return to where we began this conversation. They were the absolute salt of the earth, and they took incredible care of my dad and of my family, and I'm just boundlessly grateful for the work that they do.
So he did finally die in the fall of 2016, and holy cats, what a series of losses that you experienced over the course of that autumn.
Yeah, it was not a great autumn. You know, obviously, the kind of fundamental loss, the truly devastating loss, was the death of my father. But it is true that then there was this kind of what felt at the time like an absolutely relentless series of subsequent losses. You know, we had another family member die of cancer. I was a supporter of Hillary Clinton and absolutely devastated at her loss in the election, not just because I, you know, wanted to see her win, but because I was terrified to see Donald Trump win and terrified, you know, on behalf of my refugee father who came to this country with nothing and who was such a great patriot and such a believer in civil liberties. I was really terrified about the future of this country. And it was just, I mean, talk about the gamut from the trivial to the devastating. You know, my dad died that fall, and, you know, his beloved Cleveland baseball team, now the wonderfully named Guardians, you know, lost the World Series. It was just, you know, which is trivial, except for when you're mourning your father, who loved baseball as much as he loved, you know, America and great literature and his daughters. So, yeah, it was a hard fall in this Schultz household.
So back to the fall of 2016, after this string of impacts in your life, reversals in things you had hoped would happen and went quite the other way, what, Catherine, did you do for comfort? What gave you any?
Well, you know, above all, my partner. We've been talking mainly about losing so far, but of course, yes, before I lost my dad, I found the love of my life. And it's so sobering to me to imagine what my life would have been like in the aftermath of my father's death and the other very difficult things that followed if I had been single at the time. You know, one of the really wonderful things about falling in love is that it suddenly just gives you an entire vision for the future. You know, there's this beautiful road just unrolling in front of you suddenly. And it's, you know, maybe it's all the things you want to do with your partner or the places you want to travel or the kids you want to have or where you're going to live, you know, and we imagine it all the way out to just, you know, growing old together. And it was such a comfort and consolation at this moment when I had, you know, lost this pillar of my family of origin to be making a family of my own and to feel like, you know, as difficult as death and grief are, and as much as they take away so much of a hope for a future from you, I did have this other very beautiful future forming in front of me. And then, of course, more concretely, I had my actual partner there every day, just being incredibly patient and loving with me and not shying away from my grief, not shying away from the difficulty, but just being absolutely steadfast there beside me. So, you know, she above all got me through the experience, although I should say that you know, my mother and my sister were really tremendous as well. My mom especially had just lost her very beloved husband of 49 years. And I was so terrified for her, to be honest. I mean, they had been inseparable and devoted on each other. And my dad was a big personality and filled their life with so much joy. And I just could not imagine her without him, or I guess rather I kept imagining her without him, and it was a devastating thing to imagine. And, you know, of course, my mother did miss him and grieve him beyond description, but she has amazed me again and again with her just absolutely formidable strength and her determination to live as he would have wanted her to, which is to say, cherishing his memory, but moving forward with as much laughter and joy and generosity for others as she could possibly muster.
Well, and that's a major part of what you identify as the grieving process here for you and your family, is that obviously this is sad. You know, you've lost someone who was really important to you. And I totally related with parents to the searching behavior in grief, you know, looking for the person who isn't there. I was honestly a little shocked at first when I read the passage about how boring you find grief, but I really did end up kind of laughing because there is that to it, isn't there?
There is, you know, and I'm glad, I'm not surprised that Jacques did, I'm glad you sort of came around to nodding along, because, you know, when I sat down to write this book, I was incredibly mindful. You know, people sometimes ask me, was I nervous to switch gears into memoir and to write about such personal things? And the answer to that is actually no, you know, not at all. But I was nervous to suddenly be taking on, as my subject matter, love and death, you know. These are not small topics, and you know, it's been done before, and often quite well. So I was really mindful that if I was going to sit down and spend time and energy, including a reader's time and energy, to dwell on the subject of grief and of love, I had better come up with something useful to say, or at least genuine to say. And so to me, the kind of great responsibility of the book was to try to set aside, to the best of my abilities, all the received wisdom about falling in love or about grieving, and really take myself back to, like, okay, well, what was this experience actually like? And when I thought about the experience of grief, you know, obviously sometimes it was crushing, you know, and it will bring you to your knees sometimes. And obviously sometimes actually you're just filled with love and gratitude, and sometimes you're angry and all these kind of canonical things. But one of the things you are, at least in my experience, is just incredibly frustrated that it just keeps going on and on. You know, I did find grief terribly tedious. You know, it is not unlike, you know, back pain or financial duress. You know, you wake up every single morning and your back still hurts, or you wake up every single morning and you still haven't paid your mortgage, and you wake up every single morning and your father is still dead. And you know what? It's boring. Like, it's boring to be spending so much of your life and energy kind of stuck in this well of bleakness and grayness and dismalness and sadness. And it's all those other things too, you know, bleak and sad and you know, again, occasionally very, very meaningful. But yes, I found it to be, for long stretches, tremendously boring, because it goes on for a very long time.
So let's shift from lost to found and come a little further into the story of you finding the person you identify as C in the book. And prior to C coming into your life, it sounds like you had just sort of written off romantic love, or at least just didn't pursue it much.
Well, not that I had written it off, but I had written off the active pursuit of it. You know, it's interesting, the prospect of finding love or finding anything, right? You know, one of the things you have to figure out is, do I go searching for this, or is it just going to land in my lap? And, you know, there's no question that some things in life we need to search for. If you lost your wallet, you know, maybe some kind stranger is going to, like, open it, you know, find your, figure out your contact information and call you up. But probably you had better go retrace your steps and figure out where it was, you know. But when what you're looking for is love, you really face a problem, which is like, well, how are you supposed to look for it? You know, you have no idea who this mysterious person is. Most likely, you've literally never met them. You don't know where they live. You don't know what they look like. You don't know what they do. There's no obvious way you're supposed to set about trying to find this person. And of course, you know, these days with online dating, there are you know, ways to try to establish some of those constraints. But sometimes we get it really wrong. You know, maybe you narrow your geographic area so much you accidentally exclude your, you know, the potential love of your life. You know, or you think you want someone who's like X, but really you fall in love with someone who's like Y. And so, yes, I had tried. I knew I wanted a family, and I'm very lucky. You know, I mentioned earlier my parents were married for 49 years, and they had an incredibly loving marriage, and they modeled a happy home life for me. And I had always just assumed I would find it. It would fall in my lap some way or another. And then, you know, at a certain point when I was watching all of my friends kind of couple off and get married, I thought, boy, you know, maybe this isn't going to somehow magically happen. And so I did spend some time trying to look for love, but I did sort of feel like this does not seem to follow the same rules as the other kinds of things that we search for. You know, it doesn't necessarily reward just pure effort. And so I went through a period of pure effort. It was just hopeless and ridiculous, and I didn't meet anyone I would remotely consider spending, you know, a week with, let alone my life with. And so I did sort of, it's not that I gave up on love, but I gave up on the active search process. And then, you know, sure enough, actually my future wife did just kind of materialize miraculously in my life one day.
And through friends, is that right?
Yeah, through a mutual friend, now a very good friend at the time, to be honest, almost acquaintance is too late, but you know, a friend who lived in another city, neither of us saw her that often, but she was very dear to both of us. And absolutely in passing one day, you know, she shot us an email saying, you know, you guys should really meet. I think you'd adore each other. She was not trying to set us up. She authentically just thought we had the kinds of things in common that would make for a, you know, a fun friendship. But, you know, at the time I was living up in the Hudson Valley, and my future partner was living down on the eastern shore of Maryland. So there were, you know, several states and it was several hundred miles between us, and it was not at all obvious what we were supposed to do with this advice that, you know, we would enjoy having lunch together or whatever. But yes, eventually my partner was making her way north on a road trip to Vermont, and my hometown happened to make a kind of convenient midway point. And so we arranged to get lunch. And, you know, I can remember so vividly. It's so funny talking about that earthquake piece. I was actually on deadline for that piece the day that my partner and I met, which is a polite way of saying I was wildly behind my deadline. I mean, I was, you know, several weeks past when I was supposed to have turned in the draft of the thing, and I was struggling with the beginning. And I remember waking up that morning, and I had this lunch on the books with a stranger, and I thought, well, I'm not going to stand up this, you know, friend of a friend, and I have to have lunch anyway, so whatever, it's fine. But, you know, like, 45 minutes tops. Mm-hmm. And then I walk into town, and I'm standing there outside this cafe where we were supposed to meet, and I look up, and she's walking up the street toward me. And, you know, it's, I could never begin to tell you why in that moment, when I knew absolutely nothing about her, the world already kind of started to shift, you know. And and she came in, and we sat down in this lovely outdoor patio of that cafe and had lunch. And it was just one of these conversations that immediately, you know, no small talk, no kind of polite chit chat, no awkwardness, just deep and interesting right away. And I mean, 45 minutes, like I think 4 hours later, we stumbled back into the world. And so that's how we met.
Well, it's interesting, though, because you write of your brain reorganizing itself quickly when she suggested dinner. And that was like your first date. The second date lasted 19 days, I guess. But the level of detail that you say you have, as opposed to the haze that a lot of people talk about, I mean, it was like it was like you got to put glasses on for the relationship or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting that I can imagine that someone would experience it as a haze or a whirlwind or this kind of thing. But it's true that for me, it was the exact opposite. I mean, it was like, you know, people talk about these kind of flashbulb memories or these moments of just like crystalline recollection of their environment, which are sometimes associated with shock, you know, the day Kennedy was killed or this kind of thing. But for me, the experience of falling in love was an experience of extremely heightened awareness about everything. You know, you're so interested in someone when you start falling for them that way that you are, all of your senses are on kind of hyper alert. And I say this in the book, but I think kind of one of the most fundamental features of falling in love is this desperate craving for information. You know, you just want to learn everything you possibly can about this person. So, yeah, for me, it was so vivid. You know, every walk we took, every little adventure we went on, everything she told me about her life, just felt like it was in this kind of wonderful, high resolution detail. And you know, it's interesting. I imagine part of that is that I fell in love with someone who is unbelievably observant about the world. I sometimes think she actually sees in greater detail than I do. You know, I mean, whatever, I wear contacts, I allegedly have, you know, perfectly 20/20 vision or whatever, but I walk through the world with her and she notices absolutely everything from, you know, four-leaf clovers 10 paces away. I'm not even exaggerating, to, you know, ideas I would have missed. And so I'm sure part of it was just sort of being at the side of someone who's so observant about the world. But yes, my experience of falling in love was like, it was as if, you know, I had had uncorrected vision and someone suddenly handed me a pair of glasses. It was like, oh my God, you know, there's leaves on the trees. Like, there was everything in the world just leapt into focus in this beautiful way.
So we only have about a minute left, so I want to make this a last question, but I love the description of your parents meeting C and addressing them as sir and ma'am. How did that go over?
It was so delightful. Yes, you know, my partner grew up in a small rural community in the South, and it's quite standard for people to use sir and ma'am for their elders. I grew up in suburban Cleveland where no one did any such thing. And there was this wonderful moment when they first met, and my partner referred to my father as, you know, sir, and he said, you have to stop that and call me Isaac. And, you know, one of the many things I just adore about my partner is she's very quick on her feet, and she said, just didn't miss a single beat. She said, okay, Sir Isaac.
Oh yeah, I've been around that. Yeah, my own wife comes from the South, so I got used to some of the politeness there from the time in Alabama. But yeah, all kinds of fun stuff in the book. But you know, a lot of pain expressed here too. Catherine Schultz wrote the memoir Lost and Found and has joined us on the Jefferson Exchange. Catherine, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
The pleasure was all mine. Thanks so much for having me on.